You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African peoples, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation, Ashe, Ashe, Ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
If a child don't favor his father some way, it's a dead cat on the line. If a child doesn't favor his father some way, it's a dead cat on the line. There ought to be four ways, there better be three ways. Need to be two ways or one. If a child don't favor his father some way, it's a dead cat on the line. People today do everything they are old enough to do. Rules of few, but it seems real fine you and my friend. There's gonna be a telltale sign. Now if a child don't favor his father some way, it's a dead cat on the line. It's a shame about the mothers and fathers today, as from house to house they roam, having a good time, paying no mind to the children waiting at home. They'll play and play, and it's time to pay. It's the children that get the fun. Hey, 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 without a shadow or a doubt. Slip and slide, dodge and hide, but your sins is gonna find you out. If you still creeping from door to door, don't you take none of.
It's a dead cat on the line.
If a child don't favor his father some way, really, it's a dead cat on the line. There ought to be four ways, better be three ways, need to be two ways or one.
Is a dead cat on the line. If a child won't be like this.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. I am your host, William Rogers, and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. So happy that you are here to join us again on another Tuesday evening as we talk about the events of the world and the impact of African-American life in this world. So we're so happy that you're here tonight with us. We just were entertained by the great Marion Williams with a song called "There's a Dead Cat on the Line." And we know where that dead cat is, and we know what it is. It's called racism. It's called oppression. It's called white terror. It's had many names, and it has many faces. And so here tonight to talk about that, we're going to launch our conversation tonight from the incident that recently happened in the old KKK club called the NFL. And we just kind of talk a little bit about racism and how it has this way of seeping into things and causing all kind of different problems. So, yes, the great Marion Williams, there's a dead cat on the line. So we're here to expose him tonight. So we thank all of you for joining us, as always. You know, for those many of you who know about our format here, this is a call-in format. You can listen via the telephone, or you can listen via internet, your choice. Or if you choose and you weren't able to make either one of those, where all of our programs are archived, you simply go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com, and put in the Black Reality Think Tank, and you will be able to find our programs and listen at any time. If you would like to, if you're on the internet now and you would like to call us with a comment or make a suggestion or ask a question, you can do so at area code 215-490-9832. And I repeat, 215-490-9832. So, and also for those of you who are listening on by telephone, please remember to mute your microphones. I can hear you already, but please don't forget to do that so that we won't be distracted and you can get a chance to very clearly hear. We are going to just do a brief introduction on this subject, and then we're going to go to our callers and kind of talk about some of these things that have happened. Before I get into our thing, we want to do our ancestral profile. I just want to make note to some of our friends from the Durham area. I just posted a piece on Facebook in our Black Reality Think Tank website. There's a book that has recently been released on the work of John Wheeler, who was president of the Mechanics and Farmers Bank, which was a part of the Black Wall Street of Durham. Very excellent book. I had purchased it about a month ago and read it, and very interesting information about Durham that's not revealed in a lot of other things. It's talking about the business element, but there's a lot of other things in there too that do. And so we're going to discuss that in an upcoming program. We're going to be doing that very soon. And we're going to talk about the book and John Wheeler. The Wheeler family my family knew them well, just like a lot of you probably knew the Wheelers. He was very active in the community. He didn't hide himself, so a lot of us interacted with him. So we're going to talk about that and the Mechanics and Farmers Bank. And so also we're going to also talk in a previous sometime toward the November, December time, there was another book that was written, and I had talked about this before on the Black Reality Think Tank, Embracing the Durham, North Carolina Community, on the editor and the founder of the Carolina Times newspaper, Truth Unbridled, Louis Austin. And so there's a book that was written about him and his life. Again, somebody that was very personal in the community. A lot of us know him, rub shoulders with him, run into him in the cafeteria, run into him in the restaurant, drugstore, grocery store. He was that kind of a guy. So we're going to talk about that. But it also embraces a lot of things in history that we need to understand about, you know, the life in the 50s and the 40s and the 30s. So we're going to be discussing that as well. So I just wanted to mention those two, John Wheeler, president of Mechanics and Farmers Bank, and Lewis Austin, founder and publisher of the Carolina Times newspaper. So we want to make sure that I just let you know about that. Okay, we are going to do our ancestral profile as we always do. I have a brother that I want to mention. It's kind of be a little detailed with this because he's very important. A lot of his work is the same kind of thing that we are trying to do here at the Black Reality Think Tank. A lot of you are trying to do that with what you've been doing in your careers and your life. And so we want to show you that our ancestors were involved in this kind of work as well. Very clearly, this is the kind of thing that we want to make sure we discuss and bring forth. I want to talk tonight about a brother named Lawrence Reddick. Lawrence Reddick. That was recently an article that was written on a book that has been done by Lawrence Reddick. And the article was written by somebody named Stephen Hall, who is a professor. Let me just see real quickly what university he was. Stephen Hall was a historian, and he specialized in 19th, 20th century history on African intellectual thought and culture. He was working on a second book manuscript exploring the scholarly production of black historians in the diaspora. He is the author of A Faithful Account of Race, African-American History, Writing in the 19th Century America at UNC. So I want to make sure that we give him the credit. And so a lot of this comes from his writing about Brother Reddick and what he was doing and the work that he was doing. African-American history, as you know, has always been a communal act. It's something that we do as a community. When the great Carter G. Woodson founded African History Month, what was called at the time Negro History, he did it as a communal activity. And from its inception in the 19th century, post-Woodson, obviously, in the 19th century, African men and women, people that were ministers, abolitionists, writers, orators, bibliophiles who were rooted in historical sensibility in the lived experiences of African Americans. This is what they did. They commemorated and celebrated the black past. They did it in public spaces. They collected and preserved the raw material of the black past and produced texts chronicling the black presence from the earliest ages of humankind. They also wrote treatises and commentary. I'd like to ask those that are on the phone, would you please mute your telephone again? I'm getting some serious kind of strong feedback, so if you could do that, I'd greatly appreciate it. So they also wrote treatises, as I said, and commentaries on critical moments in the black past. This expansive 19th century understanding of black history continued to be the case in the 20th century. So rather than relegating 19th century black intellectuals to the ranks of pre-professionals, historians, and privileging the professionally trained, instead we should conceptualize this tradition as a continuous one that centralizes the communal in historical scholarship. I think of my mentor's book that he wrote on black historians. And he went back and he looked at some of the historians that we didn't even know about. People like George Washington Williams that we hadn't heard about that started all the way back some time ago. This is the type of scholarship that we're talking about. Now, this point is demonstrated in a book by David Verrill. He wrote a biography of Lawrence Reddick called The Scholar and the Struggle, Lawrence Reddick's Crusade for Black History and Black Power. Just like I said, many of you out there are continuing to fight for black history. That's why we do these ancestral profiles. it's necessary that our children know about that there were crusaders out there who were fighting for change, who were trying their best to make the differences, and they were bringing forth that history that we thought had tried to be lost. People had tried to destroy it, but they really didn't. Lawrence Reddick's life and career spanned most of the 20th century. His historical production, like that of his predecessors, was inseparable from the communal realities faced by the African Americans. Reddick's career included stints as a college professor, a librarian, a journal editor, a board member, a participant in domestic, transnational, and international organizations, community jobs coordinators, and participants in major civil rights and black power organizations. Rather than being ensconced in the ivory tower, Reddick's life and work demonstrates that far from distortion, delusion of politicalization of black history, communal nature has made it the most dynamic, engaged, and visionary project in the academy. And I appreciate those brothers who were like that. Carter G. Woodson was definitely not the Ivy League scholar. He worked in the streets of his communities. He eventually landed in Washington, D.C., and he led that movement of bringing black history everywhere. And it wasn't just in the universities. It was all over the place. That's the kind of work. The Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, the same thing. The work of the Nation of Islam, John Henry Clark. These were not Ivy League scholars. These were people that were interested in making sure that the community got the history. Lawrence Reddick's life and career, as I said, spanned most of the 20th century. Reddick was born in Jacksonville, Florida in 1912. He trained in the Black Academy at Fisk University and later at the University of Chicago. Reddick was among a small cohort of university-trained African-American historians in the first half of the 20th century. For black historians, however, professionalization did not mean the separation of academic inquiry or discourse from the lifeblood of the black community's contextual spaces and realities. At the outset of his career in the Depression America, Reddick worked as a professor at Kentucky State in Frankfort and later at Dillard University in New Orleans. He used these positions to teach innovative courses on black reconstruction and slavery, and to collect information on the black past through his work with the Federal Writers Project and the Slave Oral History Project, which enlisted the participation of formerly enslaved and employed a cohort of black interviewers. Reddick worked with the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, the organization founded by Carter Woodson, reviewing books and taking part in the association's daily work. While at Dillard in the mid-1930s, Reddick worked closely with University of Chicago-trained educator Horace Mann Bond and cultural anthropologist St. Clair Drake. He worked toward the completion of his Ph.D. in history at Chicago, placed Reddick at the center of challenging stereotypes of black intellectual capacity and inferiority. His graduate career coincided with the popularity of the tragic era interpretation of Reconstruction, the idea that Reconstruction was a colossal mistake which fostered federal control into the South, empowered lazy and improvident blacks to take the reins of government, and initiated white vigilantes, terrorists such as the Ku Klux Klan, and to the right, those previous wrongdoings. And I want you to know that that history and that work that he's done is still out here to do now. A lot of what we're going to talk about tonight has a lot to do with that history and coming from there. Reddick took every opportunity to challenge these problematic presentations of black people in history. Reddick extended his communal projects after completion, his doctorate in Chicago, and he assumed the directorship of the Schomburg Museum in 1939. He was building on a long tradition of black bibliographers. rhetoric used the Schomburg to extend his reach to African students in New York, strengthening the Schomburg collection in diasporic history and document the black experience in the West. He also worked as a lecturer at City College and the New School. He also focused a lot of his attention on the groundswell work for change in Africa. He worked closely with Kwame Nkrumah to sort of deepen the ties to the Pan-African community and challenge colonialism. Rhetoric collected black GI letters and wrote a study of black involvement in the war. He wrote a book called The Negro in the United States Navy during World War II. He did this in 1945. He recognized the importance of Atlantic Charter in 1941. Rhetoric organized an exhibit entitled The War and the Whole People. It featured 14 of the most important documents related to the war. He also convened a conference for blacks in the colonial world. And in 1945, the colonial conference drew attendees from a wide swath of the colonized world. Rhetoric's tenure at the Schomburg was followed by a return to the South in 1945. In Atlanta, he became the head librarian at the Trevor Arnett Library at Atlanta University Center, better known as AUC, and later a professor of history at Alabama State College in Montgomery. In Atlanta, he thwarted the efforts of White Zoning Commission to relocate Auburn Avenue. And those of you who know anything about Atlanta, Auburn Avenue is the main world. This thriving black business district, his civic work became the pretext for this dismissal from Atlanta University. Rhetoric's dismissal came at an opportune moment. He arrived in Montgomery, Alabama, as the Montgomery bus boycott, 1955 to 56, was taking shape. Rhetoric would play a role as participant and advisor and historian of the Montgomery Improvement Association. He co-authored with Martin Luther King the story of the MIA in Stride Toward Freedom, and he penned the first biography of King called Crusader Without Violence. Rhetoric became a co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and traveled with King to India. His career at Alabama came to an unceremonious end after the school's president succumbed to pressure to fire those involved in the civil rights activism. In the 1960s, Rhetoric traveled to Africa for the Year of Africa. He witnessed the inauguration of Nkrumah as president in June. And he also published a work called Worth Fighting For, A History of the Negro in the United States During the Civil War and Reconstruction. He did this in 1965. And Blacks and U.S. Wars in 1976. After a brief stint at Coppin State College in Baltimore between 1961 and 67, Rhetoric also continued to promote community empowerment issues and more equitable inclusion of black history in the White Academy. From 1966 to 1968, he served as the executive director of a self-help organization called Opportunities Industrial Center, OIC. OIC was a vocational program founded by the Philadelphia minister, Reverend Leon Sullivan. Under Rhetoric's leadership, affiliates grew domestically, and an international affiliate was established in Ghana. Rhetoric also played an important founding and planning role in the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in 1970. Although defunct by 1973, the organization represented an attempt to create an independent institution to promote black cultural achievement. The group was based in the American Negro Academy, and C. Eric Lincoln was its president. It had 27 members and a steering committee. Dr. Rhetoric also involved in institutional work in the White Academy. He became a full professor at Temple University in 1970, and he created courses in African-American studies and improved the library's holdings. He attended the Gary Political Convention in 1972 and reported on the occurrences there. He pushed to make the white press more responsive to black history books and insisted that Temple do more to recruit and retain black faculty and students. His outspoken demeanor led to his eventual departure from Temple and his return to Dillard, where he ended his teaching career. That was my kind of historian. And so tonight I wanted to introduce him because this gives us a clear example of the kind of work and the intensity of the work that needs to be done sometimes to make the change when you are fighting this racism in America. And so tonight, as I said, we opened up with this piece by Marianne Williams, "There's a Dead Cat on the Line." And we are here to expose that dead cat and look at it very deeply. This past week, as a matter of fact, the introduction to me took place on Monday night. I was sitting in my bedroom, in my chair, comfortable chair, drinking a glass of iced tea, and a bulletin came across and said that the coach of the Oakland Raiders, Las Vegas Oakland Raiders, had been fired for making race comments and anti-homophobic statements and misogynist stuff. His name was John Gruden. And the only reason I really paid attention is because I remember John Gruden when he coached the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when they won the Super Bowl. And the only reason I remember that is because of the brother Warren Sapp and the role that he played in the winning of that Super Bowl. And even after that, how Warren Sapp talked very heavily about the behavior and attitude of John Gruden during those years. So, but in terms of misogynist statements and racism, that it didn't shock me. Because I said, okay, so what? They all do that. You know, why is this such big news? And so, anyway, I went on to listen to the comments, and that became major news. Every 5 or 10 minutes in between the program, they kept mentioning the fact John Gruden has been fired. So tonight, I thought it was a good opportunity for us to talk about how racism is perceived many times by us. And we've had this discussion before on the Black Reality Think Tank, as we talked about how it seeps into all kinds of different things. You know, Frances Wilson's told us that in her definition of what it was. She says, in everything of human life, everything, there is nothing that racism is not a part of if you live in America. And so very clearly, an organization like the NFL, the National Football League, which is a league of nothing but billionaires and old money, that is no big deal because these are the type of people that perpetrate that kind of behavior and that kind of dog. So I thought we would talk a little bit about that tonight among our crew, find out what this dead cat is, kind of look at it from the reference point of how it infiltrates into all ways. But first, I just want to make sure that we understand what did happen. John Gruden, who was the coach of the Las Vegas Raiders, formerly the Oakland Raiders. It's a club that's owned by a family that has owned it for some time, billionaires. It's owned by the father. The father died, passed it to his son. They own it. It's one of the highest-ranking income-producing teams of the NFL. Well, the whole incident is based on a trove of emails from like almost 10 years ago that showed the Super Bowl winning coach using very coarse language. Brother Timothy, could you please mute your phone?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Also showed him using very coarse language. He's using anti-gay, misogynistic, racially charged rhetoric in emails. No big thing in terms of what these guys do. That's not a big issue. But here's where the meat gets a little tainted. So it was classic problematic word salad, as the writer said in the article, that the media feasts upon it. And that's really what happened. The media is looking always to boost things and obviously push their agendas. And so they blasted the television with this whole idea. It gave a chance for Brother Pugh, if you could mute your mic, my phone too, I'd greatly appreciate it. Let it be clear, the emails were bad. I mean, obviously, unsportsmanlike as you could be. And they were dealing with all kinds of things. And the emails were bad, as I said. But compared to some of the other stuff that they're doing, this writer said that was nothing but lightweight minor league stuff. So Gruden resigned on Monday, Monday night, last night. And he said that he's sorry. He said that he didn't mean to hurt anybody. The owner of the Raiders, Mark Davis, said in a statement that he had accepted his resignation and that the special teams coordinator was going to be elevated to the interim head coach. Gruden's departure came after a New York Times article report that the NFL officials, as part of a separate workplace misconduct investigation that did not directly involve Gruden, found that Gruden was casually and frequently unleashed misogynistic and homophobic language over several years to denigrate people around the game and to mark some of the league's momentous changes. He denounced the emergence of women as referees, the drafting of a gay player, and the tolerance of players protesting during the playing of the national anthem, according to emails reviewed by the New York Times. Gruden's messages were sent to Bruce Allen. Now, Bruce Allen was the former president of the Washington football team and others while he was working for ESPN as a color analyst during Monday Night Football. In the emails, Gruden called the league's commissioner, Roger Goodell, a faggot and a clueless anti-football pussy, and said that Goodell should not have pressured Jeff Fisher, who was then the coach of the L.A. Rams, to draft queers, which was a reference to Michael Sam, who was a gay player chosen by the team in 2014. So, right there is the reason why Gruden was forced to leave. You know you can't call the NFL commissioner that and keep your job. That was not the real reason. Yet, while the media focuses on these emails, they are not really highlighting one he wrote about Biden, some which said it's true. And former Las Vegas Raiders coach and NFL broadcaster John Gruden mobbed President Biden in 2011, calling him a clueless, that same word again, a clueless pussy, according to new leaked emails. The report reveals a litany of racist, homophobic, and other vulgar language used by the former Super Bowl winning coach and primetime broadcaster dating back to 2011, when then President Obama was gearing up to run for a second term and Biden was his vice president. Gruden is right, this author says, about Biden. I will say that I think you all agree. Well, that's up to people to say what they want to say. But let's not act like this is some huge story, he said. It was a collateral damage. These emails were revealed after the league investigated the Washington Redskins. They will all be the Redskins to me over sexual harassment concerns. The report on the Redskins has yet to be released. The Texas quarterback, Deshaun Watson, has been accused of sexually harassing over 20 women, and he's still eligible to play, according to this offer. Jacksonville Jaguars head coach Urban Meyer is probably breathing a sigh of relief right now, since he was the flavor of the week for his outing to a Columbus area bar where he was seen allegedly touching a young woman who was not his wife. It's created all sorts of locker room issues, with many noting that he might not survive the season. Well, it looks like he came out on top regarding NFL controversies, at least for right now. And when it came to the African Americans, Gruden said, he said that the player representative for the NFL, I can't remember his name right now, he said his lips were so big they looked like automobile tires. And he made that statement in his letter as well. And if you've ever looked at, he hasn't done it recently, but back when the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won the Super Bowl, to the point that Warren Sapp continuously criticized Gruden. That was back in 2010, 2011, even to the point that it appeared that there was a personal attack against Warren Sapp, where they eventually got him on, I think, tax evasion or something like that. They came after him on. And a lot of people think that was generated because he had attacked John Gruden in the way that he did. So, folks, no big news. This is America at its best. This is the kind of thing that goes on here all the time. Racism is not going to go anywhere, and you particular in a situation like the NFL. We just got out of the Kaepernick situation with the one knee. We were supposed to be boycotting the NFL. We weren't supposed to be watching these games anymore. And then all of a sudden something happened and everybody got happy and he's back to watching the football game. Again, everything's okay now. But still, the racism didn't go anywhere. That's still around. And I want you to know the NFL is probably one of the most wealthiest business initiatives that there is. For instance, the Dallas Cowboys are valued at $6.5 billion. They are the richest of the NFL teams, followed by the New England Patriots at $5 billion. Now, this is based on a Forbes magazine 2021 valuation report. You know, Forbes does all that stuff with these businesses. Number three was the New York Giants at $4.85 billion. The Los Angeles Rams at $4.8 billion. And the Washington football team at $4.2 billion. This is the kind of money that these teams make. Now, the teams are owned by old money. Money that has been around a long time. Now, they get passed around by people dying and the daughters inherit some. Just like, you know, the Walton Foundation, most of that's owned by his daughters. You know, but it's his wealth. For instance, there's the Arizona Cardinals are owned by Bidwell, the estate of Bidwell. Bidwell purchased the Arizona Cardinals in 1932 for $50,000. Now they're worth $4 billion. The Buffalo Bills were purchased in 1960. And they're worth $3 billion or so. And if you look at these families go into trace them. They're very wealthy, very well connected. Most of them conservative, Republican, if not just plain straight out right-wing racist owners. A lot of them are Southern. There is no coincidence that right now the big top teams in college football all come out of the South because they're being funded, first of all, by the alumni, and they're being funded some in strange ways from the professional realm of things. The Alabama team is probably one of the most powerful college teams that there has ever been, and followed by Georgia, followed by Clemson. And then you get into these other schools, they're very powerful. They spend a lot of money on football and sports, basketball. Duke, for instance, is by the Duke family has sponsored that. And then there's the connection to the professional realm. If a lot of them are not owned, but they are definitely heavy investors. And so right now, if you look at these teams and these owners and how much money they are making now, you'll understand why this good old boys club is going to always be this way. And I think that that's what we have to take in consideration about American business in general and just American attitude. It's usually geared by racism. Racism can hold this together. Now, Gruden is a victim of circumstance. He's got caught up in something, and he made bad mistakes. But I'm sure that what he said is no different than what Jerry Jones says in his private golf clubs when he's out golfing with his boys or some of these other owners when they say that. But he has to get exposed. Somebody has to get exposed so that to quiet things down. And this will quiet down very soon. He's losing. He has a 10-year contract with Oakland. I mean, with the Raiders. It's $10 million a year. That's a $100 million contract. And the question is, now he's not going to necessarily lose that. It's just that there's a negotiation going on right now on how what he is going to be paid out of that. But this is the NFL. This is not the only place this goes on. It goes on in the universities. You know that. These universities are just as racist and biased as they can be. They don't give blacks tenure. They don't recognize them. Look at what Cornel West had to go through. And he's a brilliant scholar. And he's not going to get tenure and he won't at Harvard because he's got to talk like Gates. And if he talks like Gates, they might reconsider some of that. But nevertheless, this is the way it seeps. It seeps his head through everything. It's in movies. It's in television. It's in literature. I mean, it's been in literature for a long time. You know, all the way back. You know, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Gone with the Wind, and some of these other horrible books that appear to be pro-American, pro-feminine, but they are not. Dr. Bridges, who comes on our program, did a book called Recapturing the African Mind, talked about the book, the story of Black Beauty, about the horse, totally about blacks. The Ugly Duckling is a racist story about things and how it's been used to teach kids alphabets and numbers. And how it's used in all levels of the academic world and doing. And then, obviously, you know business. It's definitely there in the business realm. So the reason that I wanted to talk about that is that I'm sure that most of you know this anyway. But the deal is, when we are fighting to change things, how is it that we are going to do that looking at these pillars of racism that are all around us? And one of the things that you have to do, and it has to be concretely done, and that is the coming together of our community. It has to be done logistically. We have to come together and build, very similar to the way Brother Reddick did in the Ancestral Profile. We're going to have to come together and teach our children about themselves and their culture and their greatness. We cannot expect the public school system to do that. And so that's a key to that. And this has been going on for a long time. We did not have the start that these big corporate leaders and these rich families throughout the South had. We did not have that opportunity. There were opportunities given to them that were not given to Africa. We were in captivity when they were getting those things. All the way back into the 1600s, there was something called the Massachusetts Bay Colony plantation rights that was done in 1675, where they granted large parcels of land to those coming over on the Mayflower who were worthy enough to be able to work that land and do something with it. There were all kind of other stories like that. And this is where your Philip Morris's come from. That big, huge plantation in Richmond, Virginia, that sits over off of I-95. That plantation is so big, you would not even be able to think about seeing it at ground level. It would have to be looked at from the sky. But that was built based on tracts of land that the government granted after they had taken the land from the native people, and then they ended up parceling it out among those that were willing to come over to America and build and develop that land. So you had these things like the, as I said, the Massachusetts Bay Colony idea. You had the Homestead Act that also granted large sets of land. And even when it got to the minerals, we got a little bit more sophisticated in terms of technology, and they started looking at mineral rights and oil and gas and coal. All of that was granted to power players. No African Americans were at the table, and this was given to them. They didn't have to purchase it. This was given to them, and they were able to take that and build what we have now. So your big, giant electrical power systems were started all the way back in those days. Levi Jeans started in slavery. R.J. Reynolds Tobacco started in slavery. Philip Morris, slavery. All of that goes back that far. And they were working that land, building the natural resources, turning their products into billions of dollars while we worked and slaved for them for nothing. And then when change comes and time to do something and get an opportunity, we were told, oh, wait, Negroes, y'all can't do that. Don't come up here. What are you doing? Better stay in your place. And therefore, we are not able to capture the wealth at the level. You cannot buy, if you're an African-American NFL team, I don't care if you got the money. You will not get it because that's a good old boys club. They are an organization. Jerry Jones is the chairman of the Owners League of the NFL. You will not get that. You will not get ownership of an NFL team if you come up and lay $50 billion on the table and say, I want to buy this team. You know, I like the way the HBO film did. That was a series they were running where The Rock was a part of a organization that represented the players. And it gave you a good inside look at the inner workings of the NFL. And it was so interesting because when the series was running, they were thinking about buying a franchise in Vegas. And this was long before Oakland had come over to the Vegas side. This was all just an idea. So it was somehow the other folk knew this was coming anyway. And The Rock wanted to get together with a group of his people and purchase that franchise. but, you know, that's just a television joke. And obviously it didn't happen, even in the fiction part of that. And fiction has a way of trying to explain all of that anyway. So, brothers and sisters, that's what we're doing. There's a dead cat on the line, as Marion Williams saying, and we got to be aware of that dead cat, know what it is, understand this nation, understand how it gets there, and realizing where our place is and what is it that we're going to have to do to build our power source. And we do have a power source, and there have been those in line that have tried to show us what that power source was. The Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey tried to show us. We cut his throat. And did some terrible things and stopped that organization from going. The Nation of Islam was actually been the most successful so far of this time in terms of its industrial process. I mean, you had some other things like, you know, we talked about North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, the brother that owned Beatrice Foods, stuff like that. But those are just temporary ideas that you cannot go up against the billions of dollars. And a lot of that comes from paternal wealth and paternal attitude and behavior where the whites are playing big daddy. And we might let the Negroes have a little bit, give them a little something. And we'll make it look good to keep it going. But things like this, just not going to happen. And that's what I think this incident shows us. And it also tells us that we're going to have to begin to be more concrete in terms of our building. There's no way to get around it. Because racism is in all of our institutions, all of them. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Our call-in number here is 215-490-9832. You can call us with your questions, comments, you know, and we'd be happy to give you an opportunity to do that. But right now, we're gonna go to the telephone to our friends and our guests, ask you to give your comment. Now, you can come at it any way you want. You can just deal with the John Gruden situation if you like, the NFL, or you can just deal with racism. I wanted to talk about, first of all, how that racism has permeated itself into all parts of culture, particularly music, literature, everything. It's everywhere. So you want to approach it from that, you can talk about that. But that's basically the umbrella. And as I said, the title of our program today is There's a Dead Cat on the Line. And that's what we're trying to take a look at. So why don't I do this? I want to open up and let Dr. Bridges, because I had asked him to talk about that thing, what he did in his book about the literature, and he said he had some new research that he had been able to find about how that is used and continually is used even today. So, Dr. Bridges, you there? I know you might have muted your phone, but are you there, Dr. Bridges?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. So
yes,
why
sir,
don't you
I'm here.
Talk to us a little bit about what you were doing in your book when you used those fairy tales and stories about racism and how they were employed, in literature.
Okay. Good to have you back again, too, because I've been missing for the last couple of weeks, so good to be back on.
Right. Thank you.
Let's see. It's so much, you know, whenever you start
talking
about this.
I know it is.
It's
a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. But before I go into what you just said about the fairy tales and stories and folklore and those kinds of things, I just wanted to mention that in terms of what's his name, Gruden, whatever his name is, the statements that he made, it's really a reflection, as you said, of the whole NFL and all those other all the other institutions in America.
Right.
It's no different. And I was just thinking about when you were talking about that. I thought about Colin Kaepernick to let you know that it's everywhere. He would have gotten more support if we were not there.
Right.
When you think about the support that he got, which was very little from picking big black athletes, football players who wouldn't stand with him, chicken hearted, and also who were very ignorant of what was going on, they didn't stand with him. And so it lets you know that it is quite pervasive in the NFL, and not just the NFL, but in everything that you said, because he would have gotten more support because what he was doing was right and it was correct.
Right.
But he got very little support. And
you can even
see that. And you can see that when you look at Tom Brady and you look at Bill Bradley, former basketball player who some people may not know who are listening, but most people remember Bill Bradley, New York Knicks. These are very conservative Republicans, these quarterbacks and linebackers, all these white boys, most of them are very, very conservative Republicans. And the only thing that they really have to do in terms of love and feeling for black players on those teams is to help them win. That's it. But once they set foot off that football field, it goes back to the same situation. I'm over here as a black man and you on the other side as a white man. And that's that just happens to be the case. You right. see, they get along on the football field because they want to win. In the same way they get along with us in the U.S. Army because they want to use us to win World War One and World War Two and the Vietnam War. So, you know, they want the country to be unified when 9/11 took place, you know, because of our ability to help them. But other than that, there's no love for black people by white people in this country.
That's right.
That's what we need to understand.
That's exactly right.
And even Joe Biden, when you look at last Monday, which was this past Monday, which was Indigenous People Day, Columbus Day, but now they're talking about changes to Indigenous People Day. If you notice, Joe Biden was very reluctant and never said anything though against it being Columbus Day. He kind of allowed it to be a day for Indigenous people to give their side of the story and to show that they were here from the beginning and their contributions to America. But he never, ever condemned the racist, slaveholder, rapist, plunderer, Christopher Columbus. Biden never did that.
Right.
And I remember hearing him speak about it. He did not take a stand against Columbus. So it lets you know that even in situations like that, they still do not have any love for Indigenous people or for African people, other Indigenous people, but for any other people other than white Americans. They let you know that mm-hmm. in more ways than one.
That's true.
So, and it goes on, like you said, in athletics, but also it happens in terms of academia. It really happens in academia, going back to what I was telling you earlier. I've been doing a lot of reading, and with the pandemic and time out and
right, yeah, everybody can do some reading. Yep, you're right.
Man, let me tell you something, Bill. Let me tell you something, Bill. I'm telling you, man. You most of us would be shocked at the way history has been hidden from us.
That's right.
We know it to a certain extent, but we really don't know it in terms of how far it really goes. We don't know how Europeans in those British royal families like the House of Hanover and the House of Windsor and the House of Tudor and how they historically took black people who were living back in those days, which I'm not going to get into, and who were sitting on the thrones in those days, and how these Europeans like Queen Elizabeth and others whitened their skin and married other lighter-skinned people to get rid of that black element in the royal families and all those kinds of things. And how when you read the books and read about people who knew some of the kings and queens of Scotland and Ireland, and when you read about people who, when you read from primary sources and then you see the pictures that they have given us and how they whiten the pictures, and there's a big contradiction between the pictures that you see and with the primary sources that you read. Mm-hmm. You see, they don't expect us to study and to go into all that. You see, and we just have no idea of what they have really done and how we have really, really and truly been lied to. And going back to what you said about these stories and these tales, when you look at the stories of the leprechauns and the elves and the stories of the dwarfs and the fairies that come out of Norse mythology and that comes out of Scottish and Irish mythology and the Vikings and all that. No one will ever let us know about the African element involved in all
That's
that
right.
and how they have whitened it and have talked about the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but not tell us where the whole idea of the dwarfs came from. Mm-hmm. I talked about the elves helping Santa Claus and where all that came from, the impact that Africa has had upon all of that. And so it's just pervasive. It's just tremendously pervasive. Mm-hmm. And just to end up with what you asked me. For example, in my book, I talk about one of those stories. I talk about the story of Black Beauty. We always have thought that that story was about a horse. But when you study a little further, you'll find that in the European classic tale of Black Beauty, the life of a horse is told by the author, Anna Sewell, who really is paralleling the life of that horse with the life of the African slave. Now, she published her book in 1877, Black Beauty, and that was shortly after the abolition of slavery in America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, although she focused on making people aware of the suffering of horses, in doing so, she accurately actually described the life of African slaves. For example, in one passage in the book, Black Beauty, the mother of Black Beauty says of the other colts, "These colts are very good, but they have not learned good manners. You have been well-bred and well-born, and I hope you will grow up to be gentle and good. Do your work willingly."
Right. That's right.
And so the mother of Black Beauty, or this horse, but it really wasn't about a horse, the mother of Black Beauty, or the mother of many African slaves, took the same position. But the mother of Black Beauty was well trained by the master due to the absence of the male horse of the stallion, and she in turn trained the colt Black Beauty to do the will of the master. Mm. And we can go into another whole conversation about how mm-hmm. Black men have been pushed out of the family, and how women don't want strong Black men to raise Black boys and those kinds of things, because they think they're getting in trouble. But you see it all in Black Beauty. And in the chapter in Black Beauty, there's a chapter in the story of Black Beauty, since you asked me about this, called My Breaking In. Black Beauty explains the process of breaking in and says, mm-hmm. and breaking in. And that's in the book, Black Beauty. And we know breaking in has to do with slaves being broken in.
Right, yeah, that's right.
But see, if we didn't know, we think this was about a horse, but it's not about a damn horse. It's about you. It means to teach a horse to wear a saddle and a bridle, and to carry a man, woman, or child on your back, and to go just the way that white people wish, and to go quietly. Mm-hmm. The same way that we were trained at Hillside High School, and you were in high school, and I was in high school. Go quietly. Wear nice clothes. Become a Negro. Mm-hmm. Learn good manners. Keep a haircut. Keep a shave. All these kinds of things, training us to fit into a system of assimilation into this American society, thinking that we would get more in the world by doing this.
Right. Right.
And see, it didn't just happen in America, but it happened in Antigua, it happened in Barbados, it happened in Jamaica,
all over.
And so Black Beauty learned well the teachings of his mother, so it was not difficult to break him.
Right.
Breaking and training of horses closely resembled the schooling of human slave children, both of which are necessary if they are to be of service to their masters. I want to repeat that.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking and training of horses closely resembles the schooling of human slave children, both of which are necessary if they are to be of service to their master.
Right.
And so, you know, if we're going to be of service to our masters, you know, you got to, you know, go to school, you got to get a haircut, boy. You got to shave your beard, boy. You know, you got to put on some nice pants and some nice shoes. You know, you got to go to church now. You see, so all of this was training us to be a certain kind of Negro in America.
Right.
And this is why people can talk about it all they want to, but the fact that the brothers in the NFL and the NBA, even though they don't know what they're doing, but the fact that they express themselves and wear those hairstyles the way they want to wear them, wear the pants the way they want to wear, I like it, because they're at least rebelling against a segregationist system that has kept us down for over 400 years.
Exactly.
So it's a sign of rebellion.
I always
make the statement that we laugh at the way the brothers and sisters look today, but look at the way that we look, wearing processes and wearing the kinds of clothes that we wore, and getting our noses encrusted and cut off to be more European-like noses, like Patti LaBelle and like several other people in the entertainment world, like the things that we did, trying to look like them. But when you read that story of Black Beauty, you'll also find, which is very interesting, in the story, Black Beauty was sold from one owner to another,
mm-hmm.
just as slaves were sold from plantation to plantation. You see, there was also a discussion in the story of Black Beauty about a horse called Ginger. And when you look at the ginger and what ginger is, and what ginger that herb does, that ginger, when she talked about it, Anna Sewell talked about it in her book Black Beauty, Ginger was talking about the horse and talking about the name of the horse, Ginger. But when you look at the properties of that herb called ginger, ginger is about high spirited. It's hot. It doesn't go along with everything. And so Ginger didn't have a good life on the plantation because she didn't go along with what the plantation owner talked about. And it's the same thing about the herb ginger. Ginger is hot. Ginger is spicy. Ginger is energetic. So she named the horse Ginger, you see, but she really was talking about something else.
That's powerful. That's powerful. So, Dr. Bridges, hold on just a second. Dr. Bridges, could you hold on just a second?
Somebody's making a lot of noise.
Yeah. Brother Timothy, could you please mute your mic, please, because we are hearing it.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
As I end up here, Dr. Rogers, I was reading an article by the now-deceased African-American historian St. Clair Drake. And he talked about how some of our historians are vindicationists. He said some are black nationalists. And he said some are diffusionists. And he called the diffusionists people like John G. Jackson and other people who would draw from sources, as I did, like Black Beauty, and from folklore and other origins to show where black people fit.
Right.
And so we as people, we have to go beyond traditional academic training and step out of the box and begin to understand that there's another side to the story that we have not been given privy to. Nobody
you did hear me do what? Did you hear me do the brother Lawrence Reddick? Were you on when I did him?
I did.
Okay.
That's right.
That's his work. That's exactly what he did.
And you know what? And that's what he did. But more so, you reminded me of when you told me that you were in school at North Carolina Central University, and when Dr. David Bishop, I remember Dr. David Bishop, Dr. Bishop was talking about the kings and queens of England, but he never told you about the black element and that whole royal.
Because exactly right.
He didn't know. He did not know.
Mm-hmm.
And the information was not made available for us to obtain. But see, nowadays, and this is why, like I said, I've been doing a lot of reading, people that have access to computers now, it's a wide opening. We really can get access
you can go
to
in
a
and get
lot
information.
Of information.
Right. Well, you know, that's a good example. You talked about those horses. That's why I wanted you to come on and talk about that, because very clearly there is strong documented evidence the early beginnings of developing the slave system in America, you know, was at it was elementary. They didn't, you know, a lot of those folks did not know how to, they were going to handle training of Africans. They didn't know about certain farming things that they had to do. And so a lot of it was trial and error. And one of the things I did early in my research years was I went to look for publications and books of where they were teaching each other how to do stuff. And I found a lot on things like how to grow rice and what it took to grow rice. And a lot of that incorporated the people that were going to be handling that, which were the Africans. And what is it that you're going to have to do to prepare them to harvest rice, to be able to harvest sugar? What does that take? And it's well known that these were put into books so that plantation owners and consultants to these plantations would know how to do that. And the horses was clearly one because they usually use the breeding plantations as a means of doing that. And the two main breeding plantations in America was New Orleans and Kentucky. And if you know what Kentucky,
tell our audience why. I know why, but just
you're
why,
right. You
why
know what? Kentucky was horse breeding.
Right.
And that was long after the Africans had got there. They first used the examples from the Africans to breed the horses and how it should be done and how it has to be done. And it's scientific stuff they were doing. They were talking about scientific ways to make sure that the production of Africans born on a plantation was done properly. Because when the transatlantic slave trade ended in the early 1800s in England, you couldn't go to Africa anymore, legally couldn't go to Africa anymore. It had to turn to a domestic slave trade. And they were breeding slaves in New Orleans. They were breeding slaves in Kentucky. And they were doing it around horse technology. That's documented.
And you're right, Dr. Rogers. On page 97 of my book, The Manufacturing of Slaves in America, I have a section called From Training Horses to Training Africans.
That's right. That's the way you had to do it.
And that's exactly right. And the techniques for training enslaved Africans were adapted to resemble those used to train horses due to the lifespan and stages of development of the horse.
Mm-hmm.
You see, except for cattle. Now, if you look at cattle, that's a little different. But except for cattle, most domesticated animals mature too quickly and are weaned from their mothers at an early age of physical development. The claim exerts a greater influence over the foal of a young horse for a longer period of time,
right,
which is similar to the human mother. So the way that a horse grows and is developed naturally is similar to the way a child grows and develops naturally.
Exactly right.
And I won't go into it completely
now. Let's not forget the whole story about sheep and what the sheep do. And how that history, don't forget that. Don't rule that out. It's
right.
A well-known fact that a lot of that was used in slave breeding, too, and how that was
okay,
done.
I'm going to make one more sentence here, and then I'm going to go ahead and let you go to somebody else. But when it is important to the white man economically, I want to make this point real clear. When it's important to the white man economically, he will study the habits of the black man in order to exploit him.
Right.
You see, and the white man first observed the relationship between mother and child in Africa. And in African women, they spaced their children to devote time to their nurturing and physical development to strengthen that bond between her and the baby. And then they looked at the horse, and then it all came. Anyway, I'm gone. I'm still listening.
Appreciate it. We'll come back to it. We still got a little time. I'm gonna bypass.
You don't have to. Go ahead and.
No, I'm gonna bypass the top of the hour and come on back to it. I'm gonna still stay with this conversation a little bit. Brother White, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. I'm doing just fine. Good evening to the rest of the listeners, Hotep.
Thank you. Brother White, there's a dead cat on the line. Do you see him?
Yes. So it's unfortunate that a lot of black people would get left back in the first grade.
Right.
Because to pass from one grade to the next grade, you would have to prove that you learned the lessons that was taught in that first grade.
Right.
And we have to keep learning these same lessons over and over again.
That's right.
Like this John Gruden thing is something new. So we looking at the broadcast and hearing what he said, and did he send this email, and did he say that, and
yep,
he's apologizing and all of that kind of stuff. You just have to go with original intent.
That's exactly right.
The original intent when they kidnapped us and brought us here is the same way they feel about us right now.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't changed one bit.
And you keep getting left back when you have to learn these lessons over and over again.
Right.
And instead of being able to move on from that, and focus on yourself as black people and what you can, how you can work together and organize and do what you have to do and leave everything that these white people are doing and what they're saying and all the kind of tricks that they're playing on you and these elections and all this other kind of foolishness.
Mm-hmm.
That you're waiting for Joe Biden to pass this legislation and all that kind of craziness.
Thinking you're going to get some more stimulus money. You ain't going to get nothing.
Yeah. And one of our biggest problems that we need to acknowledge is the effect that social media is having on our children.
Ooh, Lord. Mm-hmm.
With their cell phones in their hands, mm-hmm. they go to bed with their cell phones in their hands.
That's right. Up under their pillow.
They get up in the morning, and the first thing they do is pick up their cell phone.
That's right. That's right.
And Facebook and TikTok and Instagram and Twitter. And they walk around like they're in some type of trance.
They are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking to people that they don't even know whether these people really exist or not.
Right. That's right. Exactly right.
And it's almost impossible, you know, if you just took your child's cell phone from them, they might have a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
Either that or beat you up.
Yeah, you might have to take them to the hospital.
Oh, yeah, or either they're going to fight you.
Yeah.
You better know that I have to shoot you.
Yep, they're going to fight you. So...
There's poison in the cookies.
Mm-hmm. That's right. All right. All right, Brother White. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Brother Timothy, there's a dead cat on the line. You see him?
Oh, I see him, sir.
Okay.
And I hear him. I hear him and see him. I hear him loud and clear, and I see him well. Sir, I'm going to say this to you. You know, you got two brothers that gave some... good feedback, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was great. You know, so the good thing about this call, sometimes you listen to the brothers who put on the panel with us, like everyday folk that every Tuesday we're on. You learn so much. Of course, you give all you give, but they give
good.
A lot.
That's what it's about, Brother Timothy. That's what it's about.
That's what it's about. You're not kidding. But listen to me, brother. I thought about a person. Like Muhammad Ali was like a turtle when he was there in the nation in 1964. His best fight when he was in the nation, 64
uh-huh.
to 1974. And he was like a turtle. He stuck his neck out, had to put it back in and before they would cut it off into his shell. Interesting about a turtle. A turtle is very well made. I like those analogies about the horse. I learned something about the horse. I also learned something about Lawrence Frederick. I have to go to Temple Stacks
mm-hmm.
and Blocks and pull some stuff because I'm in Philadelphia. There's no way I can't find out more about that brother, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at a person like Ali, how he did that and that courage and understanding the Vietnam War at that period and learned from Elijah Muhammad, who was the first conscientious objector, and his opponents that he taught a lesson to that would call him a word that he didn't want to be called that no more, a Negro. He said, I'm no longer that. You know what I'm saying? And then when he changed and emancipated himself and gave a very high name of Muhammad Ali,
mm-hmm.
that they didn't want to give him that. But so I'm saying that to fight that, to be able to fight like that, mentally and physically, it takes a lot, Dr. Rogers. And you don't see that with the athletic like you did at that time. Now, but I'm going to give a person like LeBron James some props, too. Because when you come across these folks who are in control of the game,
right,
and you worry about your economics and your image and where you're going after that, that's a heck of a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So LeBron has been able to speak his mind and do his thing. And I looked at Muhammad Ali, who was able to speak his mind and do his thing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to know, what is the next step? Because I'm going to say this to you. You got new people now. You got younger people. Like you got Simone Biles. You want to know what is she going to, when her and her evolution, where are they going? What is she going to wind up at?
Right.
Or the tennis player. How is she going to wind up? And where is she going to be at? See, these people sometimes can turn. Look at Jim Brown. I never would have thought Jim Brown would turn like that.
And the same question you're asking is the same question that we probably asked while we were on the plantations. How are we going to end up?
I like that. I like that.
The same thing.
You are exactly right. You know, and that character, and some people say to me, Tim, you always say you like a person because they do for the community. I said, you understand that, don't you? I think that gives you the extra oomph. Mm-hmm. It gave it an extra oomph when Ali took his money and donated it and gave the Nation of Islam money for school buses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had some of the best school buses, man, in 69 and 70. He to do something like that, 72, 73. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Or when a person like LeBron does things that give back to the community, that gives you the extra oomph. Or a Danny Glover, who's in media and film.
Right.
He takes and gives back. That makes a difference, Doc. You're just going to take and spend your money on some junk and talk about the people. See, Kanye West will never go down in history as a great man.
Mm-hmm.
See, Doc, your legacy will never leave. See, you once you're gone, your legacy's going to be here, and people are going to talk about it. Your legacy, Doc,
mm-hmm.
is important to the next generation and what's going on now.
Yeah.
I want to see some good, strong legacies and some good role models coming in, male, female. We just happen to be talking about athletics now.
And that's got to come with education.
I want to see that.
That's got to come with education. Education has got to do that. Yeah
exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to add my I'm not going to say 2 cents. I got a little bit more money now. 20 cents.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For the conversation. You know what I mean?
All right. That's good. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Sister Benicia, do you see the dead cat on the line?
Well, greetings, brothers and sisters. How's everybody doing?
Doing great. There's a dead cat on the line.
Yes. Doc, I've never heard that term, cat on the line. I heard you break it down, but it still didn't resonate with me. So I'm going to say I don't understand it yet.
Okay, well, you could take it at its literal value. There's a line, and there's a dead cat laying on the line somewhere. And then the rest of it we can put to it together. It's a song that comes out of the Deep South during slavery.
Oh, okay. Well, what I'll say is this. I am disappointed. I actually take this issue of sports and black people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I am disappointed in us. And Brother Herbie really echoed with my phone is getting ready to die. Hold on one second, please. Hello?
I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, so Brother Herbie really echoed what I wanted to say, or said what I wanted to say. You know, we keep feeding into, as conscious people, I'm talking about conscious people now,
mm-hmm.
we talk about revolution and liberation and this and that, yet and still we feed into the very system that is oppressing us with mm-hmm. sports and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us that are conscious, this is how I feel. We have no business watching these things, paying attention to these things, and most of all, giving our money to these
Ooh.
Things. And from what I understand, that sports is nothing but the new plantation. I read or saw something about the, I guess, basketball players and probably football players, the college players, not getting paid and making colleges all of this money. You know, it's neo-slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we supporting
this? Yeah, it's slavery. No doubt about it.
Why are we supporting this?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we paying money to go to these games and buying paraphernalia and buying these large TVs and watching us. We're addicted to this stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It must be an addiction. I don't understand watching men beat the crap out of each other. And then when I found mm-hmm. out, because I'm not into sports at all, mm-hmm. none of them.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out that about the levels of concussions, you know, Muhammad Ali had almost had his brains beaten so that he, you know, you see what kind of condition he was in
right.
from all that battering on his head and whatnot. This is some savage stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Football is savage. Basketball, you break all kinds of bones and whatnot. Why are we paying to get involved in this stuff? I mean, okay. just like Dr. Umar said, if we could take our Christmas money and our Thanksgiving money, our Easter money, and put it together, just think of what we can do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, to build toward Black liberation, to put our, you know, to build our economics.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with sports. If we took the money that we put into watching sports and the things that I just mentioned, we could do something for ourselves. As a matter of fact, I really understood that, Doc, when you talked about the Negro Baseball League early on when I met you. And I learned some things.
Right.
I learned what the Negro Baseball League did for the community,
mm-hmm.
even financially. I didn't economically. I didn't know that. So we took, you know, money that we were making for ourselves and putting it back into the community, and now we're giving it to the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And we're their slaves.
Right.
At least we had some independence with the you know, the Negro Leagues. Now we went backward into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Getting paid a little bit more money for it, but what you doing, marrying white women?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh-wee.
You know, so, you know, there's some things, well, a lot of things that we can take responsibility for. And just like Brother White said, we haven't learned the lesson yet. And I'll finish with this. And people have said that before, but it bears repeating 1,000 times. When our young people know the names of these various sports people, I don't know any of them, well, I heard somebody say LeBron James, whatever he does. When our young people know his name, and I guarantee every one of our young people know who this guy is, what he does. If they knew Ida B. Wells' name or Denmark Vesey's name and what they did, the way they do these guys' names, then we would be learning some lessons, but clearly we're not. So we got to take some responsibility in this.
And that's a potent question you're asking. You know, why do we participate in these things? And that's a real potent issue. And there's a lot of it's not a one layered answer either. There's a lot of levels to that. And I guess each person would bring theirs. Let me ask Brother Kwazi, because he participates in sports and. You know, he's rooting now for his son to get drafted into the NFL, into that racist league. So let's ask him, why would you want to send your son, Brother Kwazi, into the NFL knowing that there are the John Grudens out there? You know, kind of explain that. And that's not a negative question to you. It's just one for clarity. And what Brother Sister Benicia was asking, why would you want him to participate in that stuff?
You know, I had this conversation with him a while back, and the other day we had a conversation, and he indicated that, you know, if things don't work out like he wants them to, he could also just coach and things. And right now he's in college, in his master's. He's getting his master's right now.
Right.
So he graduated last year, so now he's in that program. But again, I said to him, you know, if you get a chance to play in the NFL, whether you play 1 year, 2, 3 years, whatever, and you get a contract or whatever for umpteen million dollars, or you can make close to that or something like that, and you play a couple years, and you that would be a good kickstart. Whatever job that you're doing, because more than likely you're not going to make that much money. Now, I have a lot of relatives that play in the NFL and other sports. So I don't pick and choose what they decide to do. Myself, I got into boxing. And, you know, it's every sport, like you said, it's racist. I mean, it is nothing new. And I just wanted to touch on something real quick in regards to the fight, the heavyweight championship.
Right.
Now, Tyson Fury won the championship. He talked about Deontay Wilder like he was, you know, sore loser and so forth, and which somewhat I would agree with to a degree. But Tyson Fury cheated. The referees cheated on his behalf. Tyson Fury is a better boxer. That was obvious. Deontay Wilder is a stronger, harder puncher. He made a lot of mistakes in that fight. But the point is, they needed to continue to have that great white hope champion.
Mm.
Because that just changes the attitude and the power of the white people that walk the planet. Now we got a white champion, because boxing, the guy that was the white heavyweight champion was the ambassador of the world. So when you talk about somebody like Ali, there was no place that he couldn't go and he was worshipped. You mm-hmm. know, and so now Tyson Fury, so to speak, has that. And when he fought Deontay Wilder, I think the second time, he had those gloves where he had the stuffing taken out of it. Now, he also sparred with gloves like that, where his sparring partners complained about that. And then you had people like Teddy Atlas get on there and make comments that, no, that didn't happen. And they proved that that happened and so forth, but they don't talk about that much, you know.
Okay.
And so here's a guy that was probably from the blows he took in that second fight that changed what he would be doing for the rest of his career, you know. And so, I mean, that's just troublesome to me, because these sports, just like in football, Sister Benito was talking about the injuries, the concussions that you get. My son they played a game last week, and he said he got hit, and, you know, and he think he might have got a – I took a hit to the chin, and he was dazed for it. That's a concussion. And, you know, the concussion protocol and so forth, and, you know, I mean, they checked him. He's okay and everything like that. But, I mean, it's just a lot of damage that you take, but the risk. For a lot of these athletes, you know, they just believe that risk was going to pay off. But okay. he he's in a good situation. But, you know, again, when I think about, you know, and I wanted to kind of go, and I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but I wanted to kind of stay with the boxing aspect of things, whereas when Jack Johnson won the championship and they cut the fight out, and they wouldn't show him beating, you know, this white guy.
Right.
Tommy Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Burns, okay. And the name slipped me for a second. And so, you know, and they did that, you know, because, again, they can't have us being superior. And, you know, like you said, that hasn't changed. The attitude, it really does promote a shift of power in
right.
the things that people do and that they try to do today to other black people. So you find more and more people being aggressive with black people, smaller white people. It doesn't make older, this, that, or whatever, because they just feel that, you know, they're in charge.
Right.
And they're going to win that battle. And examples of that would be the Tyson Fury over Deontay Wilder, you know, and he's such, and so many black people jump on that bandwagon, and now they want to talk about Tyson Fury like he's a gentleman because he's a good talker. Now, Gruen is a good talker. He is well liked. He is an evil person. I mean, the things that he said about Warren Sapp and so forth, and Sapp got on his case. People didn't like that.
Right.
You know, because he's the coach,
And the player is supposed to know his place.
Exactly. That's checking
the
rabbit.
You know,
yeah.
So basically,
you know, these sports is a very biased situation. And that's why we're looking at this. And so, Sister Benicia, I agree that you're right, that we shouldn't, that this is a poison that we keep dipping into. But at the same token, though, all of it is poison. When you send your son to Harvard or Yale to get a degree so he can work on Wall Street, where are you sending him?
You send him to the lion's den.
You send him to the snake pit. You send him to the snake pits.
Let me make this one point.
And so I think that's one of the issues that I wanted to talk about this tonight. That's why we have to create our own institutions so that they will not necessarily be things where our children have to get exposed to success by getting their brains beat out or by getting all the legs and all their legs broken out. I wanted to play in the NFL when I was in high school, and I broke my leg at Hillside. I broke both bones. I broke the fibula and the tibia. And to this day, some 60 years later, I still have problems with my leg that I would not be able to do things that I could have done without that football injury. And so I think, Sister Benicia, you're right about that. And that's the only answer. The only answer is we got to create our own institution. Because if you don't, these kids, they're going to try to make the money LeBron makes. You know, that looks good. They want to be like a Jay-Z, you know, called Big Pimpin', you know, and doing what he's doing. And Lil Wayne, with his career, they want to be like Lil Wayne.
Yeah. But see, we have to counter something, you know. We can't just drink all the poison. Some things you got to do, you know. Some plantations, you got to go on to work and make your money. But at least you're not getting concussions and broken bones and what you just said. You know, that's just horrible.
Right.
And you know, Doc, I remember when I was younger and those listening, we used to watch wrestling. And there was this guy, I think they called him Cauliflower Ear or some crazy nonsense like that.
Yeah.
And this white guys just beating the crap out of each other and hitting each other in the head with chairs and, I mean, just horrible stuff, you know, horrible violence. And when I was younger, you know, because that's what I was taught was good entertainment, I sat there and watched it. But when I grew up and began to mature and I was exposed to something different and something healthier, I said, I don't want to see that crap. And that's what turned me off from sports, you know, totally. And so back again to what Brother Herbie was saying, we're not getting our lessons. We're not growing up.
We're not,
staying in that childlike stage.
You're so right. And we have had the lessons, the examples have been given to us. And, you know, when you really think about it, that's what Booker T. Washington was saying. He said, you got to learn how to make shoes. We need to be making football shoes. We need to be making basketballs and stuff like that. That's where the money really can come in.
We need to be making shoes.
We need to be making that's what Booker T. Washington said, and we called him Uncle Tom. Do what George Washington Carver did: learn how to grow your own food.
Right. That's my point. You know, but I mean, this is what I want to say. And with this, we need to examine ourselves. Why do we do the things we do? Why do we drink certain poisons that we don't have to drink? Most people know, even the younger ones know, that only a small percentage are going to get into whatever levels of high income in sports and entertainment.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So we need to examine ourselves and see, you know, how we're going to, again, counter all this crap that they're shoving down our throats, because we're swallowing it.
Exactly, I agree.
And that's our responsibility.
Okay, Sister Didi, you want to say something to this conversation?
Oh, yes. Peace and blessings, Hotep family. Sister Yon, so good to hear your voice.
You too, my sister.
Thank you. You know, Doc Rogers, Sister Yan, and your other guests, they said a mouthful. And I feel the same way she do about the sport. My grandson, a couple of my grandsons play football. I can't even go to the game because I don't like seeing that. Even when he was little, my son had to make me leave, mm-hmm. you know, because I was howling and cussing and before I got beat up. But anyway, what is it that, here it is, we can raise $1,000 worth of hell, go to these places, tailgate, and do all this mess. Now, where's the Rona at when the basketball ball season was out? They was winning all that, you know, making all that money. Here it is now, your baseball, your football. Where's the Rona at? Ain't nobody talking about the pandemic now because they out making their money. Right. Now here it is, you run and go get your costume, get your turkey, and all this other garbage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
come on, sister.
Call it a money grab. It's mm-hmm. a money grab. And far as y'all out there finna get them costumes, you've been wearing your costumes ever since the Rona came out. You got that mask on, these different color wigs and all this other old garbage. I mean, when are we going to stop it?
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff you're talking about. Store, yeah.
You're feeding your kids that poisonous candy. I know we eat a lot of stuff that we don't have no business eating, but we as adults know better.
Right.
So why would you get it to your children?
That's right.
I remember back in the day, my grandkids, the bigger grandkids would tell the other ones, if you going by granny house, don't take your candy because she's going to throw it in the garbage. I said, you're damn right, don't bring that here.
I got you.
I sure will. And well, if Sister I went Dina, to my daughter's house.
Let me switch over. I hate to cut you off. We only got about 10, 15 minutes. I got a couple other people I want to grab, but I got your point. I think we got your point, you know, right? Very clear. Now I want to go to Brother West. I hadn't been to you today. Brother West from Atlanta.
Hey.
How you doing, Brother West?
Yes, sir. Hey, I'm enjoying the conversation. But look here, my brother and family. I heard a brother talk about something about these myths and these stories they tell. I'm going to tell y'all some facts. I like to do facts and paraphrase. I'm going to say, y'all heard of a holiday called St. Patrick's Day, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the truth of that is, it was some people that lived over there, little sharp black people called the Twa people. Y'all heard of Twa people? They're really the Dogons.
Okay.
They was in Atlantic Island. They was in Atlantic Island, so the devils want that land. So if you capture one of them and kill one of them, you get a pot of gold. Okay, that's what St. Patrick's Day was about. Y'all can look it up about the Dogons. Okay, they're really the Twa people.
Mm-hmm.
And since my man said about Simone Biles, she's a member of the Dogon family. She's real little, like them little folk that was over there. That's why she got the magical powers of doing all the flipping and all that. Okay? So the real story behind, y'all know the real story behind St. Patrick's Day, where they talking about leprechauns and all that? That was our people they was killing. The little Twa people. You can look it up. When I tell y'all something, I got receipts. So you can look it up. All right, and then one more thing about the sport thing. What did Caesar say? Get him bread and circus. So that's all sports is circus and bread. And people going for the bread with that money.
Yes,
so
yes,
I'm like the suit to them. I'm not surprised. I played sports, but I walked away from the game in the 70s because I knew it was all jacked up and it's all rigged. All right, so it is what it is. And then I found out about, what her name, Kamala Harris, when she did that little news thing about she had some children in space camp. They was all actors. Them children was actors, man. So everything is illusion now.
That's right.
So I'm questioning everything y'all see and everything y'all hear. And now, like my brother said, we're in the information age now. With this internet, you can find out anything. The truth coming out on all this BS, man. I leave it like that, my man. Let somebody else talk.
Okay. All
appreciate
right.
Y'all.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. 414-581. Any remarks or just listening or questions? 414-581. All right. Brother Griffin, I hadn't seen you in a while. Good to see you again. I don't know if you want to say anything or you're just listening. Brother Otis Griffin. Any comments, Brother Griffin? Okay, all right, so I guess you're just listening. But anyway, good to see you. Appreciate it that you're here with us and listening. So, I think that Brother Timothy, you texted me just now. You wanted to say something else.
Yeah, I do. I understand how people look at injuries, you know, and some boxers at a certain amount of time need to put it down and maybe not stay in the ring, and money's an issue. But let me tell you something, sir. I've been boxing ever since I was 7 years old. Because my uncles were boxers. Mm-hmm. And my uncle, Charlie Hanna Jr., fought Muhammad Ali in the trials in California before they went to Rome. And so I come from a boxing family, and I take my babies with me. Yeah. And my girls can fight. So they've been learning. They went to the dojam in kindergarten and third grade. So, and they don't mind fighting guys. And because I go to the dojam with the guys, the girls will put something on the guys. So self-defense is important to me. They can do everything else. They do Kwanzaa, they read, they write, they play instruments. So I'm one for athletics. But the stuff that goes on football is a little out of the whack. And then when it comes to boxing professionally, Ali should have quit. Ali's problem was, even the Messenger told him, Ali had outside children. He had an outside marriage who, he said, that the woman that Veronica Porsche was the babysitter and Belinda was the wife. That was his second wife. See, all that kind of stuff got him in trouble. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you do this thing and you get out. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But I'm for good basketball because I played that in middle school. I'm for good fighting. I'm a Taekwondo artist, and my children mm-hmm. do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm for self defense now. But when it goes overboard, you know, and it gets out of hand, that's another situation. I guess it's just perspectives to you put it in. You know what I mean? Because
right.
I'm gonna tell you right now, if you run against my babies, they're gonna fight you.
So. I hear you. Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, one thing for sure, in relationship to. The sports idea in terms of participating in this system is that there's a history to that that goes, like I said, way back. And on the plantation, they used to take us and put us in rings to box each other. They would come, all the plantation owners, just like the NFL owners would come together and watch the one that's outstanding, and then they would make bids to try to buy him and so forth. There's a activity that occurs in the NFL called the Combine.
Yes.
And the Combine, they send all the potential athletes to this camp, and the owners and the scouts come and watch them and see who's got what. And they've even gotten to the point now, I understand, they've got machines. If they decide they want you, they can measure your certain muscle you have in your leg or muscle in your thigh and determine whether or not that you will be a good runner or not. You know, just like you would, as Dr. Bridges said, a horse. If you were going to buy a Kentucky Derby horse, a race horse, and you had gone to a horse farm to buy them, there'd be certain anatomical things that you would look at. To determine whether or not they would be capable of being able to win a derby or win a horse race. And that's that same thing is done. That's what it was done to us on the plantation. That's what the auction block was for. The auction block was to put us on display, and you go up there and you see what you feel, certain muscles, and look at the neck and look at their arms, or you look at the woman pull her dress up and look at the way her anatomy was set, whether or not she could produce kids. Or either if you wanted to see if she was a virgin, you take your finger and stick it up there to see if her hymen was broken. You know, those are the processes. So there's a history that we have coming to that point. That wasn't just something that happened. And then naturally, a lot of them, you know, were rewarded, even out of slavery. Those that would be bought as boxers and so forth, they were treated well. Yeah. The movie Mandingo was right. actually the basis of a book that was taken from plantation records. And these plantation records were used, you know, to write this particular book on how things were done. And so that part that, what's his name, Ken Norton played in there was a very realistic example of what happened mm-hmm. on a plantation. So they would become prime stock, and if they're like that. So it's a horrible system. John Gruden was just a part of it. and all the rest of them, Jerry Jones, Brother Wes, a friend out of Atlanta, the same thing, that owns Home Depot. How many of us go to Home Depot? And he's about as racist as he can be. He just doesn't say it. He's comes from a very wealthy Jewish family. He has amassed his money with his friend, and they bought Home Depot. They also own a professional soccer team. So they're extremely wealthy. And even though they may not win, that's not what counts. They still make money. Like last year with the COVID, the ticket sales were poor. But that didn't hurt not one of those team owners. As you see, nobody dropped out. Nobody sold the team. Nobody went bankrupt. You know, they kept going because that's not what counts. You know, those television stations, ABC, NBC supports them. They're supported by those breweries, Miller Brewing, Coors, Budweiser. All of that backs up that money that they use to run those things. So that's a network of what this is. And we have to create our own system. Are you going to always be playing into the system? Yeah, if you don't do that. And that's what Booker T. Washington is trying to tell you. That's what Elijah Muhammad was trying to tell you. That's what Nat Turner was trying to tell you. That's what George Washington Carver was trying to tell you. George Washington Carver even was so simplistic about it. He told Tuskegee, "I don't want no money." They used to give him his paycheck, and George Washington Carver wouldn't cash it. They had to go to him and ask him, "Mr. Carver, could you please cash your check from 2 months ago? Because you're messing up our books." Because it wasn't about that. It was about the food, clothing, and shelter. That was about, and that's being controlled by outside. Brother Timothy, you had one last remark before we get ready to go off.
Sir, I'm just enjoying myself, and every time I look, Tuesday come, I look forward to talk. I'll leave it like that.
Good. All right. Well, I appreciate all of you coming on. Thank you so much. We did find the dead cat on the line. He's there. Now the question is, how do we get him off? We got to remove him. We just ain't enough to find out that he's on the line. You got to remove him. You got to begin to do that, and we have to do that within ourselves. So whatever we're doing, whatever you're doing, keep building. Because I tell you, that's the only way you're going to ever be able to make any changes, make sure that our kids don't have to depend upon systems like this. Have a great week, folks, and we will be back next Tuesday with another discussion. Dr. Bridges, thank you so much for your input here. I'll be talking to you during the week. Have a good week, you folks.
Okay.
Thank you.